Okay, college basketball ended with the Final Four earlier this month, but as our guest today can attest to, Division I basketball is a year-round venture. We're joined today on Galesburg Live by 1991 GHS graduate Jason Shea, the former Silver Streaks basketball standout who's currently the special assistant to the head coach at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Jason has been a part of one Elite Eight appearance, three Sweet 16 runs, 10 NCAA tournaments, and five conference championships in his 21-year career as a college coach. Welcome to Galesburg Live, Jason.
Thanks, Jay, for having me. Looking forward to this.
Sure. It's good to catch up with you. So it's been a while since we've caught up, but when I talked to you to set this up, I wanted to talk about the kind of a hot topic in college basketball and somewhat confusing at the NCAA transfer portal. Can you briefly explain what the portal is, and then we'll get into some of the reasons behind it and how it's working?
Yeah, the transfer portal is a one-time. They changed the rule because you used to have, when you transferred, you would have to sit out one academic season of play before you were eligible to play. They've just thus changed that rule, and now it's called a one-time transfer rule. You can transfer without penalty and play right away. The transfer portal now, they've put some dates on it, at least in basketball. I think in most sports, or at least basketball and football, there is a specific date that you can enter the transfer portal. For us, it was April 11th, I think, or somewhere around there. It's a month long. And then it closes on May 11th, so you wouldn't be able to enter the transfer portal after that date unless you are a grad transfer, and that means you have graduated from your current school, and then you can kind of enter at any time. And a grad transfer, usually, I think you have to leave your current school to go to a graduate program that is not offered at your current school. Is that how that works?
Okay. So why was the transfer portal created? What's kind of the idea behind it?
I think a lot of it started with the coaches being able to leave and not have any penalty, or any ramifications. I think there were situations where players were in bad environment, culture, so a way for them to get out of that and explore new options, I would think, are my primary reasons.
Okay. So how does it benefit the athlete, and is there any benefit to the college?
It benefits the athlete as far as, like I said, if they're in a bad situation as far as maybe verbal abusiveness from coaching, old school coaching. We talk a lot about mental health these days, and maybe that's not a situation that is helping them. Some of it is the players don't like the. Primarily, I think kids transfer because they don't like their role, or they don't like the minutes that they're playing. Mm-hmm. Those are the primary reasons. They're not getting the opportunity they feel to play basketball. And then there's other situations, I think, that you're seeing a lower-level player is flourishing, averaging, nearly 20 points a game, plays well, maybe be player of the year in like the Summit League, the Missouri Valley, and now wants to try and, play at a higher level against better competition night in and night out. That opportunity to play on TV. So I think we kind of like it. We've benefited from it. I do think kids are leaving sometimes too early for the wrong reasons. Recruiting is not a science. Sometimes you're just trying to figure it out. by your observations and evaluations of players. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I think the kids nowadays aren't patient enough either to develop or, you know, they want everything wants to be right now, the instant gratification. And, you know, maybe they need to develop. Maybe they aren't able to beat out that player that's a little bit older than them, you know, to get on the floor and play in that specific role or get the number of minutes that they're looking for. So I think it's good and bad, but there does have to be a little bit of patience. For the school, you know, it can be a risk because you don't know what you're getting. Again, you don't know what you're getting with a player leaving, especially a player that didn't quite put up numbers. Maybe you get a kid that did put up numbers, and you can kind of see how that translates, how that can help your team. But, you know, there's also the risk of the unknown. You don't know all the reasons why they're leaving a school, but it can help you flip your roster quickly. You can get older. I think older, experienced teams tend to win in the NCAA tournament. That's kind of why, in my opinion, you know, the Kentuckys, the Dukes that do have the McDonald's All-Americans, the one-time players, that one-and-done players, that they struggle because, like Duke for this year, they had a good team. They were getting better towards the end of the year when they had everybody healthy. I think they were like 18 or 19-1. So at the end of the year, they were playing better. But they ran into an older team in Tennessee that was just more physical than them. You know, they lost. So you can flip your roster quicker.
At the same time, you mentioned that you can get better. You can also get worse quicker, too.
Correct, me too. Because you have to then try and – you're always blending new players. You don't have any foundation built where those players have been in the system. They know how the coach is. They know how things work. They're getting better. They're improving. You're kind of always trying to blend a new group of guys. Chemistry is so important, especially as you get into postseason play. And that is a challenge of getting a team together. And I think, in my opinion, that's why the ACC has gotten a bad rap over the last couple years, is because you don't know what you're getting in the transfer portal, and then getting a team together to play well early in November and December, which these NCAA committee seems to really harp on, you know, the win-loss record in your non-conference. But as I said a year ago, when we didn't get into the NCAA tournament, we're 25-10. We are 13-7 in the ACC. For a conference that has been widely regarded as one of the best, I bet you didn't want to play Virginia, who had lost to James Madison. I bet you didn't. I bet teams didn't want to play Virginia in January and February and March. You know, North Carolina, they weren't playing well there for a long stretch, but they made it to the national championship game. You know, I bet you didn't want to play them. You know, and so on and so forth in the teams. And it just takes a little longer to get your team to be playing on the same page.
How do you think it's changed the landscape of college basketball? I mean, this year, you know, there was a lot, it seemed like there was a lot of parity, the tournament. You know, it's kind of always up for grabs, but do you think the transfer portal has changed the competitive balance?
I do. I think I've always said, college basketball, men's college basketball, is the sport with the greatest parity, because you do have teams like, Fairleigh Dickinson and George Mason in the past, VCU and Butler going to the championship game. I'm sure I'm missing somebody. St. Peter's last year. And the transfer portal has just made that even more apparent. And so that the mid-major teams have a chance to beat them. You know, how long has it taken for a 1 to beat a 16 or a 2 to beat a 15 when UMBC did it? So the parity, I think, is even getting more widespread because when you look at the other sports, college football seems to be the same, you know, eight to ten teams vying for those final four spots to play in a college football playoff. Women's college basketball for a long time had been the Tennessees and the UConns and Louisiana Techs, and now it's starting to spread across the country. You know, my alma mater, they got to play in the national championship, which had never been done before. Mm-hmm. But college baseball seems to be the Texases, the LSUs, the Cal Fullertons, you know, those teams. So I do think the transfer portal is making, at least in college basketball, is making that parity more widespread across all levels.
Do you see some schools that just, you know, we're not going to do it? I think I saw the other day where Purdue, you know, Matt Painter said, you know, we're not going to get into the business of bidding on people. Do some schools do it a lot more and some just don't do it at all?
Yeah, I think, I think there was only two teams, maybe a little more last year, and there's only two teams this year that didn't have a transfer on the roster. So, I think there's a few schools that are trying to, you know, avoid it. But I think inevitably you don't know what these kids are going to do and when and why they may be leaving your program. So then you're kind of, now you're caught in a rock and a hard place. Am I going to take a transfer to replace this person that's leaving, or am I going to take a high school kid that may not necessarily be ready? So I just think coaches are trying to avoid in the spring having four or five scholarships available because of the risk, but you don't ever know. So I do think you can try to avoid it as best as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think inevitably it's going to happen on your roster.
Yeah. Do you think it's good, or do you think they'll tweak it at all, or what do you think about the future of it?
It's not necessarily bad, but there is that, as I've talked about the risk, how can they tweak it to kind of help coaches navigate it? I don't know, because I do think the being able to go and play right away is good for the kids. I don't know where they would tweak it right now. I think they're trying their best to navigate this whole situation. But then again, I think kids are rushing to decisions and possibly not being patient enough. As I was talking earlier, there were 17, about just under 1,800 transfers, and six of those didn't get picked up. So the grass isn't always greener.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. So what happens if you enter the portal and nobody picks you up?
I guess now you start to contact Division II, III, NAIAs. You know, and is that what you were looking for? Maybe it is, and maybe that'll work out better for you for what you're looking for, whatever that may be. But as I said, what we have found out, more importantly, these kids are leaving because they want a better role for themselves, or they want more minutes. They both could coincide with each other. So I don't know, you know, is it always the best thing? And then there's always, you know, coaches are kind of blindsided sometimes by kids. Maybe their parents are behind the scenes, you know, shopping their kid around, and then all of a sudden in the 11th hour before the deadline, they're saying they want to transfer, and now you're kind of stuck. So I think they've tried to tweak it by making the window of when you can enter the transfer portal on the last day, the deadline to put your name in the portal, will help, but, I don't know. So, you know, as I said, I'm not against the portal because we've, obviously had some success with it, and we've had the player of the year in the ACC the last 2 years that were transfers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll move on from the transfer portal and kind of get into your career a little bit. So you're at Wake Forest now. What's your current role? What are your duties as the special assistant to the head coach?
I help, you know, what I've always done, game planning. It's evolved. We used to do when you had a scout, we'd divvy up the schedule. Everybody, you'd have a certain number of teams, and then you had the entire scout. So you had to watch offensive side, defensive side, special situations, under, out of bounds, whatnot. You know, it just was a lot of work. I usually had the better teams on our schedule, and just, I don't know, because I helped us win, I guess. And then now we've went to offensive and defensive coordinators. So for a long time, I've been a play caller. I was with Coach Pearl, and I have been for a long time with Coach Forbes. And so now I help on the offensive side, just watching the other team's defense and coming up with, you know, how we can attack our opponents defensively. So I help with game planning, help with recruiting, just on the phone, making calls to coaches, AAU coaches, kids, their parents. I just can't go on the road. Help out with camp. We take our roster, divide it up, and each of us is responsible for two or three players academically, make sure they're staying on top of their assignments and tests and quizzes and all that, help with on-campus recruiting when we do have unofficial visits or official visits, and then any community service stuff. So, and they're changing the rule now. If you had to be a full-time coach, one that could go on the road to coach now I think starting, I can't remember, it's July 1st or August 1st, the NCAA has added two additional coaches can coach on the floor, so support staff coaches, which is what my role is. I couldn't be on the floor. I just had to be on the sideline. I could coach the coaches. I couldn't coach the players, so I could make suggestions and this and that. I just couldn't necessarily coach the players. Where now I will be able to be on the floor again, as the any other coaches, just not be able to go on the road.
Okay, so you did serve the 1 year at East Tennessee State, you know, as a head coach. How important is it for you to be a head coach again, and does it matter what level?
Yeah, I want to be a head coach. It's always been the goal, and so, you know, right now I'm getting older, and so level is not necessarily becoming that important. Just having the chance to, again, run my own program, whether that's at the Division I level, Division II level, Division III, you know, maybe I've been at JUCO, so maybe that eventually too. You know, still holding out hope here that I could get a Division I job, try to get involved with a couple this year. You know, did some research into a couple of Division IIs. So, yeah, I would be grateful to have the opportunity to be a head coach again.
So when did you know that you wanted to be a coach? And who were some of your biggest influences?
I probably knew I wanted to be a coach as my college career ended. And, you know, I was just kind of lost. Like, what was I going to do as a career? And, you know, I thought I wanted to get into the medical field. My dad's college roommate was a physical therapist, and that's what I thought I wanted to do. Quite honestly, wasn't competitive enough in the classroom, unlike my younger brother. I'm sure he took his academics a lot more seriously than I did. And you know, probably the biggest influence, obviously, was my dad. He coached me as I was growing up. Coached me when I was young in basketball. Obviously, coached Legion baseball and helped out at the high school on the sophomore team. And so, you know, my dad's always been a big influence on me as a coach. And, you know, just growing up in Galesburg, that love for basketball because of the passion for basketball there, and obviously the history. You know, I grew up with Coach Bob Morgan around all the time, and you know, he probably helped with that love of the game, and just, you know, those are probably the two biggest influences. Younger, then when I got to college, you know, Dr. Tom Davis was a good head of the game, and really we worked on special situations and making it difficult for the other team, which is what special situations to me is: the under out of bounds, side out of bounds, full court length of the floor. So that, you know, I was on the scout team, so I had to learn a new system of play or plays every 3 days, and so that kind of, you know, it made my basketball IQ higher because I had to learn quickly if I wanted to go out there and simulate the team and be able to travel at that time. And then Carl Fogel, when I went to my first college coaching job, Division II at Mercyhurst, he gave me a lot of trust, which just encouraged me more to continue to learn the game. Then Coach Pearl, as I said, he's the one that first started. Carl gave me Gannon, which was our in-state rival or our city rival there in Erie, Pennsylvania. He had always taken that when he was the head coach at Mercyhurst because it was an important game, and he let me take that over. Coach Pearl, you know, I had Texas with Rick Barnes. I had Kentucky. I had Calipari with Memphis and Kentucky. I had up until our last year when we got fired at Tennessee, I was 8-2 against Billy Donovan in the 5 years leading up to our last year. So I had all the big games. So that gave me a lot of confidence. He let me go to a lot of clinics to bring a lot of ideas. And then Coach Forbes, he just allowed me to evolve as a play caller. I called the plays when we went to the junior college and then went to and then when we got back together at East Tennessee State, I bet I called. At JUCO, I know I called 100% of the plays. Occasionally, he'd wave me off, but not very often. And then I probably called 90% of the plays at East Tennessee State. He just had that much confidence in me. So all those people have influenced me as a coach in my career.
Okay. Let's go way back when you were a Silver Streak. What are some of your highlights as a Silver Streak? I mean, it probably has to start with the upset win over Rock Island your junior year.
Yeah, it was a memorable game. You know, I think iconic place to play in you know, a couple places in the Western Big Six and being there at Moline.
What was the mindset going into that game? How confident were you guys going into that game?
I think we were, our confidence was growing. Obviously, they were number two in the state at that time. You know, I think there was a little bit of a chip on our shoulder because they had beaten us pretty badly my sophomore year. And then earlier in the year, you know, they beat us in, you know, handling their pressure and their athleticism. You know, for me personally, you know, I wanted to prove something. And I think the same, you know, with Elmer and Todd and Chad Byrne and you know, Sean was a football player, so he had that toughness mentality.
Sean Kane, we're talking Jeff about.
Sean Kane, Jeff Van Osdell. You know, so I think there was a chip on our shoulder, and it was a big environment. It was probably, you know, one of the best in the state of Illinois to go in there to Wharton Fieldhouse and play. And, it, you know, obviously it was a tight ball game. And I had the ball as the shot clock was – or shot clock. As the clock was winding down, uh-huh. And I got free and just remember, you know, I got to a pull-up at the elbow and was fortunate to make it. And, yeah, it was a big, big moment, exciting. You know, we had struggled for a couple years there and to get to that point of playing a sectional championship was exciting to, you know, get to the Sweet Six or get to super sectionals, I guess.
Right.
And unfortunately, we couldn't get it done, which for a team that we had already beaten earlier in the year.
Right. So I've often said that the Shays are the first family of GHS sports. I don't know if anybody's accomplished what you and Zach and Bo have, both, you know, on the field and off the field. What do you think led to all three of you having, you know, such great careers?
Just probably the competitiveness that my dad and my mom had instilled in us. You know, we had competitive wiffle ball one-on-one games growing up. We competitive, you know, basketball games as well. Zach took more to, you know, playing football. He had that middle child mentality and toughness, and so he was he pushed me because of that competitiveness, and you know, he wanted to prove to his big brother that he could compete. And then we just kind of beat up on Bo, and he had to kind of do the best he could to survive in advance. And I think that competitiveness just carried over to our playing days. You know, we wanted to be the best and bring Galesburg back to some of the glory days that we had heard about. And I used to sit up there across from the bed. I can't remember if it's the south. I think it's the south deck, you know, with mm-hmm. my grandparents up there. They sat up there across from the Silver Streak bench. And I remember seeing Eric Johnson and Byron Theory and all those guys play, and Casey Piggy and Goodman. And, you know, the list goes on, and just want to, you know, etch my name in Silver Streak lore, and I think my brothers wanted to do the same, and that just kind of pushed us, and we were self-motivated, self-driven.
But it also carried beyond your days of Silver Streak. You know, what I was kind of getting into is, like, you guys were great athletes, but you've gone on to great careers at high levels, you know, with mm-hmm. Bo being a doctor and Zach being an athletic director and a former coach himself.
Right, and that's where I think that younger discipline, the self-drivenness, the motivation, it just carried over. We learned it at a young age, helped us in high school, helped us in college, and then we knew what it would take to be successful in whatever field we went into. You know, I've spent a lot of time I continue to learn to this day. I don't think you ever quit learning. And so that mentality was manifested in us. And you know, the same with Bo. Bo, being a doctor, like, you know, he's getting medicines changing all the time, and he has to stay up with those. And he's not only stays up on the techniques, he was one of the first residents in the country to do a cadaver transplant on an amputee. And so, you know, he got to learn that new technique and forward thinking then, and the same thing. I think the year we went to the Elite Eight, we were one of the first teams that started icing or downing ball screens, basically keeping it on the sideline, because I picked that up going to a clinic. And now you see it more common in college basketball than you did. But we were one of the first teams, and I think that just helped us advance, just, you know, staying a step ahead of the game. And the same with Zach, you know, he learned from a lot of really good coaches along the way. I think they were innovative. He played on, coached on the defensive side most of his career. So, you know, just coming up with exotic pressures and blitzes, just helped them be successful, throughout his career and the stops that he had. You know, all of that self-discipline, motivation, drivenness, was instilled by our parents.
Okay. Finally, we're going to wrap things up here, but, you know, you and your wife, Jana, have a daughter and a son who are growing up and doing some great things in life. Tell us about what they're doing now, where they're at, and what's the future looking like for them.
Yeah, so Paige, my daughter, she went to ETSU when we were there as freshman year when I was the head coach. And then when we moved over to Winston, she took a gap year, and kind of like her father and uncles, she wanted to do the big school thing. So she is now the sophomore at North Carolina Chapel Hill, and she's loving it. But she had a good high school career. Her team made it to state her senior year, you know, so she enjoyed basketball. She picked it up. She worked hard at it, and got the experience having some success. And then my son, Joel, he's just been around. They both have been around the game their entire life, obviously.
And right.
He picked up that love for the game, and he would come, and I'd put him in workouts with our guys just as far as doing the skill development, not necessarily playing. But he got that love for the game. He was a junior this past year. He'll be a senior moving forward. But he was able to hit a game-winning shot that sent them. North Carolina just has 64 teams, just like the NCAA tournament. So he hit a game-winning shot on a dribble handoff with no time on the clock. They were tied. He hit a dribble handoff three that advanced them to the Sweet 16. So he got to experience that moment, and they carried him off the floor. And so as a dad, that was a proud moment to, you know, see your son.
Yeah, I think the president and co-president of his fan club here, John and Laura Shea, kind of let everybody in Galesburg know about that basket. But it was pretty cool. I mean, it's kind of eerie how much he looks like you, he plays like you. So it's got to be kind of fun to follow his career.
Yeah, and so he's I got to be at the game too.
That's great.
For a lot of his career, I haven't been able to see a lot of his games, but I was in there that night. I think we played at home the next day, so it was awesome. My parents came here and spent a month, and so they could watch him play and see us play four times. And then my brothers came down because they celebrated my 50th birthday this year, and so it was good to have them all down here. But yeah, Joe is now, he's been doing the travel ball thing. You know, he's hoping to earn a scholarship, whether that be Division I, Division II, or whatnot. So, just early on in his career, on both of his careers, I was hard on him, being that coach. But then, you know, I finally realized, hey, I need to be their dad and be there for support and encouragement rather than always trying to be their coach.
Right. Okay, well, Jason, I think that'll wrap it up. It's been great catching up with you, and continued good luck in your career, and thank you for joining us today.
Well, I appreciate it, Jay. It's always good to talk to you, and love to do it anytime, and maybe more often, just keep checking in. But you've been a big-time supporter of our family, and can't thank you enough for that, for what you've done throughout the years, and what you did for the Register Mail. It was important for the town and for the city of Galesburg and its residents. So thank you as well.